And I would like to take a couple minutes to kind of review yesterday. Yesterday I talked briefly about noticeable time periods in child rearing through history, running from a mode classified as basically dealing with the days of antiquity up until the modern day. And that range from what's classified as an infanticidal mode on raising children, in which they were not very highly regarded and killed with regularity, to the current one that we're in, which is helping, which is just appearing, and that is one in which we focus on the child in the growth and development process, and the adults respond to the needs of the growing child, primarily the first 6 years of life, and direct all focus on that regard. And it's quite a change when you look at this in historical perspective. Also, yesterday I dealt with another issue, which was research that if children are raised in rather horrendous conditions, that we would, from an adult standpoint, find totally unacceptable or highly questionable as to the outcome. That certain super kids, as they're called, have amazing ability at this point to survive those kinds of lifestyles that we would perhaps not want to experience ourselves or to create for our own children. Okay, and I wanted to pick up with an issue that I didn't get to deal with yesterday before dealing with rearing of children in non-family kinds of situations. And the issue I want to start with today is, I want to focus on for a while, is the one dealing with the role of the father in child rearing. But before I do that, I want to backtrack here for a minute and dealing with some other kinds of information. There's an individual by the name of Arlene Skolnick who is very much interested in child rearing practices in our society. And she states that many studies trying to document the effects of early pathological and traumatic conditions have failed to demonstrate more than a weak link between them and later development. I indicated yesterday that we have tended to use a medical model in working with people who present problems such as mental illness or other kinds of concerns, and we try to look at the current plight and then unravel it and go backwards in time. She also notes other factors interacting with the child's cognitive processes and sense of self limit the parents' ability to shape their children. Perhaps the most basic is that parents have their own temperamental qualities that may modify the message they convey to their children. One recurrent finding in the research literature, for example, is that parental warmth is important to a child's development. Yet warmth and acceptance cannot be created by following behavioral prescriptions since they are spontaneous feelings. Further, the child parent-child relationship does not exist apart from other social contexts. A study of child rearing in six cultures, directed by Harvard anthropologists John Whiting and Beatrice Whiting, found that parents' behavior toward children is based not so much on beliefs and principles as on a horde of apparently irrelevant considerations, such as work pressures, the household workload, the availability of other adults to help with household tasks and child care, the design of houses and neighborhoods, the social structure of the community. All these influences, over which parents usually have little control, affect the resources of time, energy, attention, and affection they have for their children. Skolnick adds, instead of trying to rear perfectly happy, adjusted, creative, and successful children, we should recognize that few, if any, such people exist, and even if they did, it would be impossible to produce such a person by following a behavioral formula. Far from harming family relations, lowered expectations could greatly benefit them. There's one person who would disagree violently with that that last bit of information in that we could, in fact, produce happy, well-adjusted people, and that would be B.F. Skinner. He, of course, has taken the work of John Watson and is of the opinion that we can pretty much shape individuals any way we want them if we know how to manipulate and control the environment and the reinforcements, that we can produce anything we want. That gets to be a debatable issue, but there is pretty good evidence to indicate that we can do a lot of shaping of people to the kind of outcome that we would like to see in the way of behavior. Okay, on the issue of the role of fathers, two myths that are generally associated with the father's role in children raising. The first one is that fathers have little impact on the development of the child. The second myth is that fathers cannot be as a nurturing person as a mother can be, that the father has no kind of sense of being a person who can nurture and help his children develop. The late Margaret Mead once noted, "Fathers are a biological necessity but a social accident." Two individuals, both males, challenged Margaret's notion. They are Ross Park and Douglas Sawin. And they reveal through their research that fathers are not a social accident. Instead, they contribute significantly to an infant's social and intellectual growth. And fathers can be trained to be an extremely valuable asset to the mother in the process of raising children. We have not tended to focus on that. We have largely in our society had the practice of having the mother assume most of this responsibility, with the father only being a bystander and a helper in some kind of emergency situations. Fathers can be just as nurturant and stimulating as mothers and are more apt to hold and look at their infants. That last part of that statement has to do with the fact that if you observe how parents, particularly fathers, interact, they will spend more time holding their infants, and they will look at them more than a mother would. A mother would be apt to be doing different kinds of things that would take eye focus away from the infant. They note, however, that fathers participate less in routine child care, such as feeding, changing diapers, and bathing, than the mothers do, but they spend four to five times more time in playing with infants. That when you observe fathers in a situation in which you're watching their natural kinds of reactions and tendencies, and you measure how much time is spent, they will spend more time, four to five times as great as the mothers would, in play with infants.
Perhaps if the fathers did the bathing, the feeding, and etc., then the mothers would spend more time playing.
That could very well be true. Also, fathers tend to be less verbal and more tactile, and the father-infant attention shifts rapidly from peaks to valleys. The observed behavior is that there are high and low points in father-infant relationships. They may be very intense for a while, and then they drop drastically. And they also engage, fathers tend to engage in more physically arousing and unusual activities than mothers do. It's not, I wouldn't think it's uncommon to have a father take an infant and balance it on the hand and kind of carry it around the house this way. You know, hold it up and almost touch its head on the ceiling, that kind of thing, and then let it drop all of a sudden and catch it. I've seen many fathers do that kind of thing, and that's a kind of an exhilarating, almost frightening experience for babies, but they seem to love that kind of thing. And it gets back to that notion that I mentioned, or that practice that I mentioned, of that we had when we used to swaddle infants and toss them from one building to the next as an adult game. that somehow fathers still seem to think that tossing infants in the air is some kind of exciting, pleasant thing to do. Another thing research has shown, that babies as young as 5 months are more at ease in social situations when their fathers help take care of them, as opposed to the mothers only. And as a result, the infants also prove to be calmer and happier when left alone with strangers. There is not, apparently, a great separation anxiety there when both parents are involved, as opposed to the mother only. The father's greatest contribution to the infant's cognitive process is in the quality of play, whereas the mother's greatest contribution is in the area of verbal stimulation. And well documented that females have a higher verbal ability than men, and this is a natural, kind of natural process that mothers would do more in the area of verbal stimulation. Any questions you want, or comments you want to make at this point? Okay, I would like to make one comment relative to the role of fathers, and I guess I see it more so because of the changing role of men and women in the society, and that fathers are, in my estimation, engaging themselves more in the process of helping raise children, more so than in the past, and it's not viewed solely as the mother or the wife's responsibility, but it is, in fact, there is movement toward it's being shared as equitably as possible. And in situations in which both parents have to work, I think we're then seeing that perhaps both parents take the time that they're not working and relate to their children in different ways than they normally would. There may be an improvement in quality on the relationship that exists because both have been absent and away from the children during the day, and they have time toward the end of the day in which to spend it. And I think, if anything, the quality may improve because it's not such a drain on both of them all through the entire day, particularly the mother. Okay. Next, I want to deal with the rearing of children in non-family situations. And I would like to start with the best example that we have in terms of research support, and that would be the system that's evident in Israel in the kibbutzim, in which you have these outlying areas in Israel in which families congregate under a community or a communal system. And in the kibbutz, it is the responsibility of individuals who are assigned the task of raising children. And this is not a parental responsibility. In the kibbutz, after a woman has given birth to a child, that child is taken from the mother. She has a six-week period in which she does not work full-time. During that 6 weeks, she is encouraged to breastfeed the child, but she does not care for the child. The child is taken from her. And they are raised in groups of five initially during the first 18 months. After 6 weeks' time, the mother is expected to go back to work half days, and each month thereafter to increase her working hours by 1 hour. So in about 10 months, she should be back to about an 8-hour workday, what we would classify as an 8-hour workday. Well, the whole system there is designed to have everybody have some contribution. parents are expected to work. At the end of the day, the parents come back from the fields or whatever their assignment is in the commune. They do not necessarily eat with their children, but after the dinner hour, they are allowed to be with their children for approximately 2 hours. The children are kept in what we would classify as some kind of a dormitory arrangement, in which they have a night guard there. But if you've ever seen the inside of a Israeli child dormitory, is my best description. You have cribs that are stacked one on top of another against the walls, and these things are patrolled at night because of the danger of the terrorists in the areas in which the kibbutz are located. Parents have no responsibility for raising the children. This is all arranged by people who are take care of the whole socialization process, the whole education process, the whole introduction to the work ethic in the commune. This has been going on in an organized fashion now for 70 years. And you may have as many as 400 people living in a community like this, in which everybody has an assigned task. And once the youngsters are past the toddler stage, much of what occurs with them is to acquaint them with what is occurring in the larger kibbutz community. They are taking out to see what people are doing in the way of work. They have their own group, but their groups are very small, 5 to 6. As they become older in the normal growth process, the groups are reformed, and so that may go from a group of 5 to a group of 10 or a group of 12. Even when they're in high school age, they still do not have any kind of parental contact other than a couple of hours a day. The parents have no responsibility for the raising of children. When they're of high school age, they combine with other kibbutzim, and they'll have what we would call a consolidated high school, in which those of high school age go to a common school. But again, the parental contact is minimal. What is found as a result of research here is that many of the Israeli leaders are products of the kibbutz. The people here tend to have a great feeling of community. They are raised in an atmosphere of cooperation. If they didn't cooperate, they couldn't survive. They tend to be above average intelligence. They tend to be very warm and sharing people. They do not tend to intermarry. If their marriage partners are tend to be from some other area in Israel, but they do not tend to marry in their own kibbutz. And it seems to be an interesting kind of situation. We could not do that in our society. Our society would not accept that nor tolerate it, because we are too competitive. We are not a cooperative society. We could have small-scale operations like that in kind of isolated areas, but to say that we could adopt that as a system of child rearing in our society would be just a monumental kind of endeavor to try to think through as well to implement. Any reactions to that kind of approach?
That sounds scary to me. Aren't they all sort of like, they all seem to then have the same value system, and what happens to what parents have to pass on to their children, the heritage?
That's all taken care of by the educators in the system.
But it's similar like in Russia then, it's like a communistic state.
Mm-hmm. But that's that they're very familiar. They're going to continue in that kind of same lifestyle unless they...
Are people happy that way?
They seem to be very happy, well-adjusted. They tend to be very cooperative people.
I was just wondering, this the other night. Back 10, 12 years ago in our country, when people seemed to be getting into communal experiences and hippie-type communities, whatnot, raising families and kids in a communal atmosphere with a very reduced lifestyle and all that, I was wondering, whatever happened to those people? Those are kids now that are second, third graders, whatever. Have there been any studies done that you know of to look into the 70s to see what has been the result of some of those kind of alternate sorts of lifestyles that seem to crop up in the 60s and what's going on with those children now?
I don't know of any, and the reason that probably it would be very difficult to find any is because they never lasted long enough to provide any kind of a database. The communes that were started in the last 10, 15 years have a very short lifespan. I think the closest you could come to a communal situation, what still has family orientation, would be to look at Hutterites, Amish, Mennonites, closed, very homogeneous, a common religious background, stressing cooperation, but it's not really communal, but it is a community. But we're into so much cultural pluralism, we can't come to agreements, and our attempts establishing communes are not very good. We don't have a very good track record. Yes? Not to my knowledge. In fact, if they're interested in anything, they're interested in expanding.
I probably think there'd be low motivation. I guess, for me, to have a child, part of the fun of it is having it in a family situation, loving it, raising it myself. And if I were to give it to somebody else to raise, I don't know if I'd want to go through the pregnancy to give it to somebody else to raise.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, you see him at night, that kind of thing. But I guess... in America we talk so much about the bonding between the mother and the infant and how the first few years is so important in its mental and emotional health. What would those studies say about that kind of thing? That the substitute mother person then is the bonding person?
A surrogate mother.
Really mother to hundreds of kids.
That's right. At least to 5 or 6 to start with.
Yeah, but I mean over the years.
Mm-hmm. The special training, they have their own training. Schools there for training the those who work with the young children. Special program for that. But a mother surrogate can, in fact, be as good as the natural mother. And even our own studies in this country would support that. But yes, we have a different philosophical look, and we think, that separation... it'd be traumatic, but it's not borne out in their research. They're very healthy people, emotionally, psychologically. It's hard to say that they're making a mistake, but they have to have everybody work, otherwise they can't function. Everybody has a role that they must fulfill.
What do they think of their parents? Are they just another person, or do they recognize them as their parents?
Yeah, they recognize them as their parents, but there isn't that great emotional attachment.
And it's a security for old people, I presume they are well taken care of too.
Yes. It is a true community. But you have an assigned task. And one of the things about the Israeli experience is that as a child grows, they're given the opportunity to experience many different things. And ultimately, they can decide what they would like to do in the commune, if it's not the one they're going to stay in, some other. Because they get to experience all the kinds of activities that exist there.
Yeah,
one of the interesting features was that that's been stopped recently is that they had common restrooms and showers. In other words, they had gang showers, and this was practiced up until age 18. They have now stopped that practice. But one of the comments made in one of the one of the books I read or articles was that one of the researchers was asking one of the high school kids, "Would you ever marry another member of this kibbutz?" And the student said, "Oh, I couldn't do that. I mean, how could you marry someone you sat on the potty next to?" You know, that was the response. That was interesting. You know, they don't seem to conceal anything, and may have a more wholesome attitude about sexuality, for example. Any other comments or questions about the kibbutz as an example of non-family? Okay, yes?
Well, I was just thinking in terms of why it would be a good idea is we have so few trained parents, we have so few people who really know what they're doing with their children. And when, you know, I teach children who are casualties of poor parenting or no parents or no family, how this would be such a good advantage. And that's why you're coming out with, you know, actually better off. Although a lot of children maybe with good parents, what about those that don't?
Yeah, I have a bias there. I think we're more concerned about teaching kids how to drive cars when we know darn well that a lot of them are going to end up being parents, and we don't teach them anything about parenting. They just pick it up from what they experience and what they hear, and some of them may do some reading and talking with other people, but we don't make any serious attempt in our society. The only way we get to that in any serious way is when we deal with people who are going into teaching or into daycare work or nursery work, and the state requires these people to be licensed to practice their trade. Then we get some assurance, at least, that the people are licensed to do this kind of thing. But we don't license people to be parents. And one of the interesting things that Margaret Mead had at one time, I don't know how serious she was about this, but she advocated a two-stage marriage. The first stage was a five-year experience in which you could have no children. That was forbidden to have children, and if you passed that first 5 years successfully, then you got authority or license or something. I don't know how she was going to control that, to have children. But her view was that it's better to get a marriage well established before introducing children, and in that five-year time work could be done with individuals to prepare them to meet parents. Something to think about. It's hard to control that kind of thing, though.
If we went into educating young people about parenting, I think we'd run into trouble because of freedom of religion. There's too many ideas about what's right and wrong about parenting to come to a general.
That's where our cultural pluralism enters into it. We can't always agree.
I'm wondering, the studies document pretty well that people will tend to be the kind of parents that they were parented under and so forth. In other words, I'll be the sort of parent that my parents were to me. Because as I talk to a lot of people, especially my age, and I think I'd include myself in the same camp, we say, you know, my parents made mistakes with me, and I have a lot of ideas of things I want to change, and I'm not going to do a lot of things that, you know, in ways that I was raised. What does the research really show on that?
With child abusers, the cycle repeats itself. That's definitely obtainable in the way of evidence. It's very strong, and it's very difficult to break that cycle. Those who are abused as children will, in fact, as adults, produce children who they in turn abuse, and that cycle keeps going. Now, it's harder to get information on family situations in which they're in the non-abusive category. However, there is a general feeling that we tend to also, with some modification, we tend to react to our own children the way our parents reacted to us. But there's also evidence to support the fact that parents are thinking through more how they are going to react. In other words, they are anticipating more how they are going to respond and how they might do things differently. But that's rather recent, I would say probably 200 or 300 years old now, that we've gotten into that kind of thinking. And we do so on more so on the basis of what we didn't like as opposed to what we liked about what our parents did. But the abusive, or the child abusing parent, that's difficult and that's pretty well established. Best work, to my knowledge, done in that area is done in Colorado. University of Colorado, I think, is heavily into trying to work with known child abusers and trying to see if they can set up some system to break the cycle. Any other comments?
Speaking of educating parents, I teach, and I find that when we do something in our school district to try to have some kind of parenting skills type thing, the parents who come are the ones who are already doing a pretty good job, and the ones who really need it don't come, and that's really frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you get them there. It's, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know either. You can't force them to be there.
I teach parenting classes that I have for years, so it's often that one that comes, and I agree, basically the one that comes, although I have some that were potential abusers and they have said so without the group they would have. And when they see what has done for them, they see a neighbor or somebody in group, then in need, they bring them, and that has been, you know, times of really crisis that made the difference of you know, abuse or training, and then a role play or something. And they might come for just in crisis situation, but they know because it's an ongoing thing. It's once a month, the first Tuesday of each month, they know it's there, except this month because there was an hold, but otherwise, every month they're here, and they know it's the place, and that has been very supportive, just to know they can come and accept it where they are. We have intelligent Jewish mothers, and we have uneducated people, you know, who don't know the basics, and so it's hard to get the good point, but it is, you know, in a way supported, I think.
I've had 2 years' work experience as an elementary school counselor, but it was really the wrong kind of program because we were crisis-oriented. But we had high parent interest because the parents of elementary age children still believe that they can do something to correct situations. Whereas you get into junior high and high school, a lot of them just throw their hands up in the air and they won't even bother to respond. But we were not preventative. We were crisis oriented and dealing with some very serious problems with 6-year-olds on up. But we found many parents who were able to follow through with alternatives and suggestions that we offered. We didn't tell them this was the correct thing to do. We said, no, this is a possibility, this is a possibility, and you really decide what you think is something that you can do. But that was on a one-to-one kind of situation. It was no group effort here. But it's difficult to get them to respond. And they'll do so in a crisis situation, but they don't see it in a preventive way, which is more the direction I would like to go with it.
This may be off the track too far, but I'm thinking of children from a one-parent family. My son just went through a divorce 2 years ago, and he made every effort to get custody of his children, which he did not, was not successful in. Do you think the trend will be eventually toward fathers getting more, and that would be an advantage to the children, or...
Well, I don't know.
It's an old law.
Yeah.
They still use why the mother should best to be the custodial parent.
I suspect there is a slight trend. At least I would think the courts. Yeah, it's very slow, and the courts are. I think taking a better look at the situation.
Children with just a mother, I can see where mine suffered, and I would think. Many of all of them would, to a certain degree. Of course, you might suffer more to have a bad parent of two. You don't have two parents and one of them be a very poor parent. But even so, I think children are entitled to two good parents if they can possibly have. But I don't think a good parent, a bad one, is better than one good one. I still don't feel that one good one is always the right answer.
Okay, some other situations. Burton White, who is at Harvard, became very interested in how children begin to differ at about age four. And he has been involved what is known as the Harvard Preschool Project, which is also known as the Brookline Early Education Project, Brookline, Massachusetts. What he and his research team have been able to find thus far is that we can, in fact, provide excellent daycare centers for children that may, in fact, be better than anything the family might be able to produce by what parents believe is correct, or by having the mother remain at home and not work. That daycare, if people are properly trained, may in many cases be better than what the child would get at home. It may be more stimulating, more exciting, quality, and the adult contact may be far greater than what a mother and a father could do. And that, I think, in daycare centers are going to be very much needed in our society, with the fact that if we do not somehow alter our society, that we're going to have both parents employed in order to maintain a family.
You mean for children that have two parents?
Yeah, but even for a single
parent. Well, they're there's a lot more to be required in daycare centers. I don't think they offer nearly what the people who don't have children in there think those children are getting. They're not always getting what they claim.
Yeah, I don't want to give the impression that all daycare centers are equally high caliber.
Some are in there for
many of them are like nursing homes. They vary the way from excellent to abominations. But all of them have to be licensed by the state. And they all offer things that would attract parents to have their children enrolled in these programs. But the fact is that mothers in our society are not able to remain at home in many instances, and they must work. And therefore, there ought to be concern about good daycare. We have daycare, one of our Lutheran churches in Springfield operates a daycare program for 1-month-olds up to age three. And some mothers drop their babies off there at 6 in the morning because they're going to work.
I think it depends on who's watching them.
But there is a question about how good is that care during the 8 hours or more that that infant is there. Many of them are still crib infants. But the state is concerned about the nutrition program, the adult to infant ratio and things of that nature. How much these people know in the way of information about child growth and development. Things of that nature. You know, but there's a great, there's a, we have a, the one in Springfield has a graded scale. If the family situation is one that it's below the welfare, government welfare line, then there's no fee. It's free service. But if the people are above that, then they pay accordingly for the care. And I think we have to look at that as some direction we have to pay more attention to in our society. And the comments on that?
Well, I think if you're going to have daycare centers, you have to watch carefully. Some state control, we better be very aware that it's not becoming like the Russian, where all kids are in and parents are required to leave their children there. And you no longer have a say, and they come all out. They all come out the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're all subjected to the same kind of thing. And if we're really care as parents, we better watch that our daycare centers are going the right direction. But we still have individuality and a higher ratio of trained people and loving care, rather than if they're just there being careful while a parent is gone. In our area, we have some in the, I would say that maybe our, well, begin with the Head Start program, but a lot of them are sponsored by people who spend a lot of money putting them in. And consequently, we're creating a greater gap among the children than helping them. We have the very wealthy children, and the parents who can afford to put their kids there, they're all doctors, lawyers, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The average person can't afford that excellent care. And then we settle for the mediocre in the other area, and they're not getting what they should have. So it's still not bringing it up to where the children are equally cared for, that we're equally concerned about.
You know, a good example of that is the fact that we have virtually destroyed Montessori in our society. Maria Montessori, if she were alive today, would, I'm sure, you know, just be mortified at what we're doing. Now, her original idea was to take kids who were, in fact, you know, the urchins in Rome, the future derelicts in the society, and put them into a program that did something for them. But Montessori in our society is for the middle class and up. It's aimed at the wrong kid, and it costs money to send your kids to Montessori, which is can be a good program, but the wrong people are in it. Then we have franchise. Any of you experienced any franchise daycare centers? Anybody got those? They're popping up with regularity. It's the same. It's like the same kind of building. It's like Kentucky Fried Chicken kind of stuff. Popping up all over, supposedly giving a quality kind of program for infants and young preschoolers. And one has to look at what's the motive behind that. I'm sure it's a profit motive, rather than quality in the way of care.
You mentioned the book of Bruno Bettelheim's Dialogue with Mothers. It really should be Dialogue with Parents, I think.
Go ahead.
It's in paperback and it's excellent. And he himself teaches, has been at the University of Chicago for many, many years and has written a lot of books on child care. And he calls children that he works with his children, and that's like 400 or 500 of emotionally disturbed children, and how they work through the problems with them. And parents can come to him with their children, and a lot of them sense something wrong even very early
you know, that they're hyper or they're not sleeping well, they were this way as a baby. You know, what do I do with this child I can't control? And he starts out with the premise, first of all, a parent has to look at, what do I want the child to be? And most people have to talk about that. You know, they're just having children and raising them the way they were raised or what they see their neighbor doing and so forth. Without thinking about, what do I want my child to be? Do I want it to be another me? Or do I want it to be an individual by himself and then encourage that growth? And he gives examples like, one parent was terribly disturbed and called the child naughty because it ran on the street. And he had to tell them that that's, running in the street is not naughty. The child has to learn to do that. But until a certain age, you have to leave that child until he knows that going in the street is dangerous, but it's not naughty. And we do that often as a parent and scold the kids for something that we either don't want to take care of the problem and explain it, so we just say, oh, shut up, or, you know, why? Mm-hmm. And if we look at it, I think it would be very helpful to many parents to look at that, to look at these books and see what he's saying. Another interesting facet he has is the enchantment of fairy tales, that we've taken all those out of books, I mean, reading books and so on, and they're very helpful to children in development of learning what's good and evil. And you, as a parent, he goes into a sex sort of thing analysis, but as a child reads them, you don't discuss it. The child figures it, it's good and evil, the reward for punishment. Reward and punishment for things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And through his lifetime, he wants those stories reread and reread, and you become his substitute characters in them. You know, sometimes it's a brother and sister that they is the witch, or the parents are the witches. And the child works this frustration out, and that's why that's having read over and over and over again as he develops. But you don't do any interpreting on that. And he says, we've taken something very special out of our school books and our storybooks by removing the fairy tale, even if they're awful. It's a release for them to figure out what's right and wrong. And I think that that's something that we should watch too. Are they putting them back into our textbooks? And if not, then parents should read some of these at home.
Mm-hmm. I forget the name of the book and the author also, but the general thrust of the book is the children's need to deal, to have a certain amount of horror as they grow up and develop, as they grow and develop. And the typical way we present this is through fairy tales and things of that nature. But it seems like it's almost a necessity for them at that point.
Well, we took them out of the reading material, but we let the violence go on the TV. And they see that, and they see the person remains dead, and it's up again, so it doesn't mean anything. But in the story, it does. It becomes a very real thing. There are some of the books in the store. The Enchantment of Fairy Tales, I think, is in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the dialogue from it has been there.
I think that's very interesting in light of the fact that I think the story is sort of being rediscovered in the church, the children's sermon, which we all know is basically for the adults anyway. But I had one professor who said that, you know, if you have to explain the children's sermon when it's all over and say, boys and girls, what's the moral of the story? You missed it. It ought to be like a fairy tale where you just lay it out, you tell it, and it's self-evident enough that you don't need to moralize with it and let the thing speak for itself. But I'm happy that at least we're sort of rediscovering the power of telling stories again. And I think that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
Okay.
teenager. I remember there was an interesting book I read of who's the lawyer in New York City?
Stringfellow.
He's an Episcopalian. He's a lawyer, but he's an Episcopalian and terribly interested in theology, almost, you know, is a really a great theologian as well. And he was assigned to taking care of a teenage class in the Sunday school. Nobody wanted it. And the church was in an area where they were losing ground, and so they had in the parish hall, they had a swimming pool, and they wanted the neighbor children to be able to use it. And the only thing they could do was say, you're welcome to use the pool, but we ask you to come to Sunday school on Sundays. And he got stuck with the class. And he didn't want to leave it, but he just decided to read the word. They were a terrible gang within the group. And
They did all kinds of things to shock him at first, and they brought six packs with him on Sunday morning, and all he did was say, did you bring your can opener, and go out in the kitchen and get one, and we'll all share it. I mean, rather than make a big to-do about it, he just said, this is what we'll do. And, but he kept reading the word, and he said, I'll ask you one thing, that you get a Bible, and the next, because we're going to read the Bible. And the next Sunday they came and were proud that they'd even stolen Bibles just to have one. And he still didn't say anything, but all he did was read the word. Didn't explain anything, and he did that Sunday after Sunday. Finally, the kids all came around, and the worst offenders were the ones who came to his house and said, that book is special, and it means something to you. He said, yeah. And from then on, they did a complete turnaround, and he got them interested in reading Scripture, and they were just speaking. And I thought that was a real interesting way in which he approached those kids, and just not try to explain anything or give a moral judgment on them, but just enlighten them in the gospel. I think it says something for what we are doing.
Well, just because of the power of the word, I know of a girl, she works with retarded children, and all she does in the break time does read Scripture. And during the course of the year, the children were hyper and become more quiet, and she doesn't say anything, they're just reading just the word. And I firmly believe that the Spirit, no matter what your mental state is, the Spirit responds to God's Spirit, no matter what state you're in otherwise. And I think that's what you're saying.
There was a mother here last summer, or late in the fall, and she had a three-year-old child that was absolutely delightful. Behavior, intelligence, and that child had picked up so much. And I mentioned to the mother, I said, you're very verbal with her, aren't you? Because you could tell by her vocabulary, she wasn't quite three. And she said, I read a lot to her, and I figure if she can get the words and know what they mean, I'll just keep doing that. And she said, all the time I was nursing this baby, I read Scripture. And she was having another child. And right after that, we had Jane Rickey, who works with the special children at the University of Washington was here, and she talked about the early recording that's done, and they find out in that 2 weeks of age, that baby is recording already and can tell a round shape from a square shape because it sees its parent's face, and things are recorded in that little mind that you're dreaming. As early as 2 weeks. And this clued this mother in too. She said, I'm having another baby, and I'm going to read more Scripture to this child. And she had also been encouraged by somebody in their parish. Said he taught his child some very special songs in a foreign tongue. And his grandmother had sung them to him, and he really didn't know what they all meant. But he taught them to his daughter, and it wasn't him. He said, every time I picked my baby up, I sang this and sung it to her. And years later, when she was about sixth grade, he walked by her room, and she was singing, and he thought, I don't believe that somebody else is teaching her these songs. And he said, where are you learning these? In school? And she said, no, I've always known them. I've always known that song. And it made him realize, too, that that recording that's being done in that little child is there to stay. And I think, therefore, the stories in Scripture, it's a wonderful time to be doing it and not saying about it. Just get it in there. Now I've said my piece. I've been a teacher and a parent, and I work with special handicapped kids.
Let me ask you a question. What do you think the role of the church ought to be in the raising of children or educating parents?
I think it should probably be available in some form, and in a way I think it is. Mm-hmm. But I don't think enough parents realize it or take advantage of it.
Okay, would it be, you think it's possible to have adult classes in parent education as opposed to, let's say, adult Bible studies? Do you think that would have appeal, or do you think people would just say, oh, that's interesting, but I wouldn't participate?
Well,
Anybody?
Look at the Mormons. I mean, every week they have training and you know how to raise their children. And I must say, I have many patients with, you know, six children, but they are exemplary. If the children are well behaved and they learn a lot, and the parents feel secure because of it, and I think they can do it. Why can't we? We have lots to offer in the Christian faith.
I think one of the really valuable things we can do is provide intergenerational experiences, outings, retreats, classroom things. A lot of churches will have, like during the Advent season, evening programs, like an hour and a half sort of craft thing where parents and children will work together on a project, maybe some kind of parish decoration or some study or something, and then a worship service to go along with that and make it a seasonal activity. And I think that's one of the, since I've been here at Holden, that's one of the tremendous things about Holden is it's an intergenerational experience. You have everybody from these little tikers to senior citizens and all doing similar activities in a similar environment and sharing. And that's, I think the church is at fault when we regiment our activities. You know, we have little kids groups and the junior high kids and the senior high kids and the young adults and it's all broken down, and we need to somehow find activities we can all participate in together.
Well, I think one of the things that is important is to have the children attend church with their parents. You know, sometimes in some churches the children are excused, you know, and they aren't really encouraged to attend the service, and if they make a noise it's just, you know, hush hush, you know, you shouldn't be here. And I think the children were created by God too, and they should be there, and they should watch their parents worship. And this is a very subtle way of educating the children.
Mm-hmm. Were you here earlier this morning? No. Were you here for the Chuck Mayer's?
Oh, really? No.
John, your wife said some interesting things that a lot of people agreed with. She said only in the last 10 years has she looked forward to going to church. First, when you had your four children, and she was going bananas, you know, and didn't look forward to going to church on Sunday because family was split up here and there, and it wasn't anything to look forward to. And that's something to really give some consideration to. How do we structure the church experience so that that expectation is realized and it's not dreaded? Well, any other comments?
I think one problem in getting a program like that going, though, is our pastors are just so busy with all kinds of other things going on that I think we need to train lay people to do those things and get them going. We need those things going, but we do need trained people, and our pastors are just going bananas trying to get everything else done.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you going to answer your question?
What?
I wanted to answer your question about how we're going to structure the church, because as a mother of children, I am really interested in the answer to that question.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what, you know, how, where do you begin to violate the liturgy, for example, things like that. I would be at a loss. How do you restructure the worship experience so it's still joyful, worshipful, and that all can benefit from it? The way we have it now, I don't think there's only a certain element that benefits by it.
Well, we could do little things. One of the first things our oldest son announced to me when he was 6 or 7 years. We want to go along to church. And when I discovered why, he was being excluded. He was not allowed to come up to the altar when he came. He was, you know, doing little things like just simply letting the children come along with the parents to the altar. Or a blessing if you're at church camp or anything else. Or making parents responsible for training the church. Suppose instead of the pastor teaching that confirmation class, because I'm really and doesn't want to learn anyway, the parents were made responsible. The children could come and be confirmed anytime the parent and child thought they were ready, and the parents would be trained to do the training of their children if they felt they were ready. And just take it out of the hands of the, making again,
people responsible for knowing that they don't have the education, they don't feel that they can do it yet. Their parents might teach them how to teach the kids that. And my brother is doing that now for the confirmation class. The parents are responsible. They meet once a week at the church to get some help. But the pastor does not teach that class. There are individual little classes going on all over that church. They'll find a place. Parents come along. And if a kid needs help, a kid can go as fast as he wants. The teacher does that to learn. Parent helps him learn. If they need help, that's where they get it.
Yeah, I know of some, in addition to parental involvement, some different approaches by pastors, not to have confirmation classes at all. But the student, when he wants to talk with the pastor about what he is learning and going through in the confirmation material, makes an appointment to talk it over with the pastor. And it's a one-to-one kind of situation. That may not be a wise use of the pastor's time, but it's a different approach. And the same thing can be done with the parents, having meetings and discussing this material.
We're trying to structure our church now. We have very different. We have First Communion at age 11, whatever they're ready. And then we have a confirmation type materials. I don't know how to describe it. That are available on Thursday evening. It's open from 4 till so forth. And there's always someone there. And then if they need to talk to the pastor or something, it's available. And also on Saturday. And then they can go as fast as they want to, whatever. And we have the resources. And it's very slow, but I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
I find the families are more involved too.
You find people being confirmed different months of the year. Yeah. There's nothing so bad about that. But we tend to, it's a class here, it's a class there. And we might want to rethink that.
And that's your job, is it more like a high school or college curriculum with adults, parents teaching the different classes, and so the kids are free not only of which classes they take, but what part of the year. So if they want the summer off, they don't have to take a class in. It's all individual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have in our church what we call a Trinity series, which involves the parents and also the young adults of the church to train the children, I think, from sixth through eighth grade. And it's quite successful. They come once a week, like at 5:30, and some of the mothers prepare a meal. They take turns. And then they have a sing-along afterwards or something for of that type. And then they have a class afterwards. And it's quite well received there. Do you know anything about the Trinity series?
I don't know.
It seems like something. Have you had it in here?
Yeah.
It's quite successful. And that age children needs that early basis.
One of the most effective parts of our son's confirmation was when our pastor came to our home, and in fact it was about 2 days before he was going to be confirmed, and discussed his written statement of faith that was required from him. And I appreciated that hour's visit from our pastor so much. It seems like the communication level between the parents and the pastor and our son was very real, and I thought how wonderful it would have been to have this through these 3 entire years, that he made at least 3 visits, or even, even more. The lack of communication between the home instruction, between the pastor and the child, was definitely lacking there. I would have liked to have seen more personal communication between parents, the pastor, and the child. But of course, again, like you say, so much is put upon our pastors, but I thought that was a real meaningful experience for us.
Well, anything like that, as much as possible, is good. The more, the better. But then you've got to come to, you can only get so much of that because of time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the atmosphere of the home is very,
uh-huh, sure,
rather than the church office,
uh-huh,
pastor's
right.
office. That lended the, created an atmosphere that was very positive.
Mm-hmm.
But I was brought up, where you never went to church with the family until you were confirmed. And I think, from my experience, I mean, I was very happy. I don't think I ever missed it. Of course, my parents didn't listen anymore, that I could say I wonder what it's like to worship with them. But I know the way our services were later on. I mean, I think I would have really been turned off if I had been forced to sit through a service. And I still have trouble with the children at church because I find I have to, I mean, even though they're not ours, I find in order not to be distracted, I try to keep them busy and bring something along for them to do. So that but my worship life is disturbed because of the children around there and to let them cry and so forth or crawl under the bench and so forth, and unless you sit in the front pew, and even there you might have children. So I think you have to also consider the worship life of others who don't have children or older people or so forth. And I think, with due respect, and I love children, but I don't know if that's a place for them to be at all times. I think one thing that is very important to me, the children learn early to respect and respect other people's needs, and this would be one area. So I would be one for advocating that the children, maybe for special occasions, but not every Sunday, would be, and most, I think, are sort of made to sit it through, and if the mothers are very good and creative, they manage for them to sit still during the time, and I often wonder what goes on the mind of the children if they don't pretend to having sitting to sit still when somebody talks about something that they don't understand anything about. Mm-hmm.
I think that's important in light of the fact that it seems to me that people in my home congregation feel sort of an obligation. They've suffered under this thing of take your kids to church. And they feel this obligation to have them there. And if they send them to the nursery, that's like they're shirking their responsibility. I think as a church we have to kind of free those people up and say, hey, it really might be appropriate if you just don't bring your kids to church. It bothers me when I'm preaching to have some kid cry, and I think it bothers most pastors. And not that it bothers my preaching, I think you could talk right through anything, but it bothers me because I know people are listening to the fuss that child is making, and you can see it so visible in their faces, like you say. And that is a disservice to the other people, and that's a beginning of teaching responsibility. And I wish we could somehow free people's minds up to not feel guilty about it if they want to make use of the services of the nursery.
At one time we had a nursery that had a microphone in it. My youngest son was small. And we did use it a great deal, and then we could also partake in the services, which I thought was good. But you don't always find that.
No.
I think you'll find many churches having the children in for part of the service, right up to perhaps after the children's sermon, and they're dismissed to go on to some other activities in the educational unit. We have that in our congregation. I don't know if that's true. But then the sermon, of course, is geared toward the adults. And that seems to be effective. We haven't had any complaints.
I think I find with my grandchildren, if we make them go with us and sit still, each Sunday gets a little better. But if we miss one and let them come out the next Sunday, then we have problems.
Boy, that consistency is
right. Yeah. And I don't think it's all that bad. If a child's going to cry and make a big fuss, sure, take him out. But bring him back as soon as he settles down. He's going to learn that just like he'll learn anything else. Yeah. That's part of parenting. I think that's our responsibility, to teach those children from the time they're little, because they don't have to go when they're little. Then when the time comes when you want them to go, oh, you're going to have a problem.
Just when would you start?
But then, isn't the thing that we want them to enjoy it, whether or not they go, because they can't?
They have to learn to enjoy.
Yeah. No, but you.
I think we need to learn how to make it enjoyable.
Right. Well, I think we're hung up on a fun thing about life nowadays.
I think adults should enjoy church too.
Well,
children, if we're going because we think we should, there's something wrong.
Right. Yeah, and I think this, in having, like, you know, we had that having for the children, that you enjoy being in church. not necessarily fun, but we should enjoy being in the presence of the Lord, worshiping and so forth. And I think a child is a child, doesn't have the mind of the adult and has different needs. And I don't think you can combine the two in one thing. And maybe having, you know, there's a compromise, the children's up to a point and they're part of it, then they go. But I mean, the pastor cannot address anyway his sermon to all the levels of everybody. That's impossible. And then take, you know, little kids and big ones. I mean, and it's just a matter of training them. That's just like training kittens or something else. You know, if you don't sit still, you get strepsimistic or whatever.
How many times do we have young people when they're confirmed or when they graduate from high school? That's the last day.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, whether it's because they didn't have to go when they didn't want to, or whether they had to go when they didn't want to.
That remains to be a problem. And part of the things I'm sure they don't see, they see that as a graduation or termination. They have nothing to do after that, really. There's no reason to keep them coming back. At least they don't consider it as a reason to come back.
Okay.